From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Cambridge and Somerville push back on e-scooters.
You don't get to just flip us the bird, you know, and come into the city and think that we're just supposed to, you know, roll over and thank you.
Also today, the untold story of five female pilots who risked it all to prove they could fly.
These brave women who at times gave their lives to do the thing they loved and were blamed for their failures, unlike the men, were forgotten.
Plus, Weezer covered Toto's Africa, and I think it's awful. We'll ask some songwriting pros what it takes to make a great cover. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we'll begin today with an update on the electric scooter company Bird. The California-based company launched its shareable dockless scooters in Cambridge and Somerville last month without notice to or permission from either city, we should note, which is why both cities want the scooters off their streets. But those birds are still out there. WBUR's Bostonomics reporter Callum Borchers has been following the story, and he's with us now. Hello, Callum.
Hello, Meghna. Yes, I opened the app moments before we sat down here, and they are still available for rent.
You can see them out there on the streets of Cambridge and Somerville. So why, though? Because both cities said that they were going to round them up and take them off.
And they have begun to do that. So public works crews on their normal routes, as they encounter the scooters, have been picking them up and taking them to the DPW yards. Bird can still go and get them out of the pound, so to speak, just like any citizen who leaves an abandoned bicycle could do. And what they're doing is they're just putting them back out on the streets every morning. Despite the cease and desist letters and even a threat to sue from Cambridge, the company is undeterred.
So remind us really quickly why both cities said that they don't want these e-scooters on their streets.
Two big points. One is safety. Both cities have officials who are concerned about the way the scooters are being driven, right? Whether people are wearing helmets as they should, whether they have licenses as they are supposed to, and also whether they are being left on sidewalks, maybe blocking wheelchair ramps. And the second question is whether the scooters are even legal in the state. There is a state law that says electric scooters should have turn signals and brake lights. These scooters have neither. And right now there's an ongoing review at the Department of Transportation to see whether it is indeed a violation.
I see. So you've spoken with Cambridge Mayor Mark McGovern about this. What were his main concerns?
Well, he basically said that the company isn't thinking about the constituents that he does, right? So the company is targeting mostly millennials, people on their commute. It's a last mile solution, as they say. He says they're not thinking about the little old ladies. This is what he told me.
What's going to happen when they hit a senior citizen? And again, this isn't to say they shouldn't be allowed to operate here. It just has to be done thoughtfully. And there's a process to it. And you don't get to just flip us the bird, you know, and come into the city and think that we're just supposed to, you know, roll over and thank you.
Yeah, McGovern was really upset by the sentiment that they should just be thankful that the city is here. He read aloud to me the first email that he got from the company, which was on the day of the launch, by the way. He didn't get advance notice. Hmm. And he said the email basically said, tweet, tweet, congratulations, we're here, as if this was a gift to the city. That was really off-putting to the mayor.
Let's just put a moratorium on all the bird-related puns, too. Now, as of last week, Callum, you hadn't heard from Bird in the course of your reporting. You'd reached out to them, but they have released a statement to you since then, or you've heard from them?
They've spoken only in written statements so far. They did put someone on the phone, an executive on the phone earlier this week with my former employer, The Washington Post. So we got big timed on that one, Meghna. But the argument there, which I found interesting, was that the company supposedly does a legal analysis before launching in every market. And if they think that it is legal to operate there, they will launch, but only then. So according to that philosophy, they have supposedly analyzed the Cambridge and Somerville markets and Massachusetts generally and determined that they are legal. I'm not sure what basis that conclusion is rooted in, but that's what they say.
Because we have local and state officials saying the opposite at the moment, right?
That's right.
And I'm seeing the Bird statement that they released last week saying that we have been giving productive conversations with local. We have been giving productive conversations with local leaders and look forward to continuing those conversations in order to build a framework that supports affordable and equitable transportation options for the whole community. Does Mark McGovern in Cambridge think that they're having productive conversations?
Not lately. They've had two meetings between Cambridge officials and Byrd, but none lately. He says talks have essentially broken off. However, talks continue between the city of Cambridge and Byrd's chief rival, which is Lime. So there are multiple entries in this rentable electric scooter market. And McGovern has nothing but positive things to say about Lime doing business.
Lime has been working with the city. Lime has been trying to do this the right way. They are trying to get permits and work all of this stuff out. They are trying to do this in a way that respects the entire community.
Now, Callum, sometimes I find it hard to keep up with all of these new forms of transportation. Lime bikes or Lime scooters?
So Lime operates both, and in the Boston area, we have seen the Lime bikes already, the dockless bikes, and we've heard Mayor Walsh in Boston say he doesn't like the way they're operating because it's only blue bikes. But Lime also has electric scooters.
Got it.
And we've seen them on the West Coast. We've seen them in other cities. Cambridge is interested in having a rentable electric scooter system. They just think about maybe wanting to have some more rules in place beforehand, and I think it would be a very interesting twist if at the end of the day, the city ended up sort of sticking it to Byrd by signing a contract with the number one rival.
Interesting. Okay, so what about users here? I mean, it seems like a lot of people actually like these e-scooters. I mean, it's a great idea, honestly. Do they want them to stay? Do the users want them to stay?
They absolutely do, and they are fun to ride. I in fact, own an electric scooter of my own, Megna. They are fun, there's no question, and they are convenient, and they have ended up with a very quick, high adoption. I was out earlier this week talking with some riders about their experiences, and I ran into a woman named Bella Valentini. I met her in Cambridge, and she says that she thinks the scooters are just terrific.
They're really fun. They're actually quite fast. They're not too expensive. And they feel safer to me than I'm not a big biker, and I like that you have a little bit more control over where you are. I think the mayor should definitely allow them.
Sounds like she loves them.
She does, although she did run into a problem the day that I met her, Megna, which was that she couldn't find the scooter that she was trying to rent. And this is a pattern that I've seen a lot this week. In fact, in the course of my reporting, I have found, or not found, more than two dozen what I would call ghost scooters.
They show up on the app, but they're not there in real life?
Not there in real life. The GPS app is supposed to take you to the location where you can pick up a scooter. Remember, there are no designated docking stations. And once you arrive, if you're having some trouble, you can hit a button and chirp the scooter. It sort of sets off an alarm, same way you might look for your car in the parking garage by honking the horn. But they're not there, and this is a recurring problem. And so what I can't figure out and what these riders can't figure out, Megna, is whether it's just technical difficulties or perhaps a form of trolling the city.
Trolling the city? That would be cruel, but I don't know, very Silicon Valley bro, in my opinion. But back in the day, several years ago, Uber was doing this too. Remember, Uber had ghost cars to make you think that there were a lot of Uber drivers around. And in some places, they didn't have as many as were showing up on the app. So, you know, perhaps that it is something deliberate. But I trust your reporting as it progresses to find out the truth there, okay? Now, Byrd is very well funded, right? So there's an issue of sort of what's going to happen next and how many lawsuits, Byrd can absorb. What kind of investment do they have?
They've raised $415 million in venture capital. And a lot of it came just recently. Just in June, late June, they raised a $300 million round. The lead investor on that is Sequoia Capital in Silicon Valley. They were behind YouTube, LinkedIn, Instagram. This is the big time. And so with all that kind of money, they can really afford to incur some fines along the way.
Wow. Okay, so what do you think is next for Byrd in this area?
So two big things to watch. One is the review from the Department of Transportation. Will they come down and definitively say you can't operate in the entire state? That would be a major conclusion one way or the other. And the second thing is to see whether Cambridge makes good on its threat to sue the company. They have said in the past in their cease and desist letter that they might seek an injunction to get a court order and say you definitely can't be here. They haven't taken that step yet, but that's also something to watch.
Actually, it just occurred to me, since Cambridge and Somerville want these these things off the streets for now. When a user finds a bird and rides it around, are they going to get ticketed?
So far, I haven't seen any evidence of that. Okay. In fact, I was struck. I was watching one person ride over the ComAv Bridge construction right in front of a whole bunch of Boston police officers, totally unencumbered. So it seems pretty clear that at least the city officials, they're more focused on the company and cracking down on them as opposed to individual users.
Well, WBUR Bostonomics reporter Callum Borsch is there talking to us on the latest in the saga of bird e-scooters in Cambridge and Somerville. Thanks so much, Callum.
Always fun.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The year is 1933. Hundreds of thousands of people have assembled outside of Chicago to watch the Frank Phillips Trophy Race. Seven pilots, six men and one woman, soon begin whipping their flimsy planes around large pylons set up across the field. They're flying less than 100 feet off the ground at speeds up to 250 miles per hour. Now, this was a race that changed the course of aviation history, and it's just one of the incredible moments that Keith O'Brien uncovered while researching his new book, Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. And Keith O'Brien joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me, Meghna.
This is a great book because, you know, when people think of women in aviation history, one of your fly girls pops up in almost everyone's mind, right? Amelia Earhart. But there are four other women here. Can you just run through their names and tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. So, you know, what I've done here is created sort of an ensemble cast, yeah. You know, this coterie of women who were friends. They were rivals. They would, when they crashed, they would rush to each other's bedside and be there for them. So Amelia Earhart is obviously one of those. Ruth Nichols was a daughter of Wall Street wealth from New York City, possibly Earhart's greatest rival in the early 1930s, and also her friend. Ruth Elder was an Alabama housewife who in 1927 was determined to be the first woman to fly across the ocean. This is months before anyone, most people anyway, have heard the name Amelia Earhart.
Right.
Florence Klingensmith, who was possibly the most talented of this bunch, hailed from a small little town in Minnesota. And Louise Thaden, who was the rarest kind of aviator in these days. She was not just a woman who flew planes and raced planes. She was the mother of two young children.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about Florence Klingensmith, right? Because she was the woman in the Frank Phillips Trophy race, right, in 1933.
Right.
Okay, first of all, tell us about the nature of this race. The idea that we would have airplanes flying at 100 feet off the ground around, they're flying around pylons in a field?
Correct. Imagine, the simplest way to describe it possibly is imagine NASCAR in the sky. They would set up triangular courses in a city or around an airfield using 50-foot towers. They called them pylons. And you would take off with a handful of other planes and race around them. So not only did you have to avoid crashing just because you're flying at 250 miles an hour, just, you know, 50 feet off the ground, but you have to avoid crashing into the pylon itself as you make the turn. You have to avoid crashing into one another. And Florence Klingensmith, who was from Minnesota, was one of the best pilots at this kind of flying. It required the utmost coordination, the use of both your left and right hand, you know, one on the throttle, one on the stick,
yeah.
the use of your left and right foot operating the rudders of the plane to make those hard turns. It was very hard to do.
How did she get into aviation?
In the most unusual way. You know, she was the daughter of a farmer. But she was different her whole life. In her little town in Minnesota, she rode a motorcycle at a time when young girls didn't do that. In the little streetcar in her town, she didn't ride in a seat. She would cling to the cow catcher up front, you know, just inches off the rails. She was a daring young woman. And, you know, like a lot of women, she fell into a job that she didn't really want at the time. You know, she ended up working for a dry cleaner in Fargo, North Dakota. But when Charles Lindbergh visits her city on his Goodwill tour just months after flying the Atlantic solo in 1927, Florence Klingensmith sees him like thousands of people did that day. You know, and she tries to shout to him as he rolls by in his car, you know, sitting on the back of the convertible. And he didn't reply to her. He ignored her. And that bothered her. That upset her. And she said later, she said, and I'm paraphrasing here, you know, I'm going to show him that, you know, Not just a man can do this kind of thing.
Yeah. So this Frank Phillips Trophy race, she was the only woman in the race in 1933. Had women been allowed to fly in the race before that?
No, not in this particular race. Women are, first earned the right to race airplanes in 1929, but they were only allowed to race against each other. Men didn't have them racing against them. And in the races that they created in 1929, they created all kinds of restrictions on the women that men didn't face. For example, not only did they have pylon races, they'd have transcontinental races, you know, races from, say, Los Angeles to Cleveland. And when the men did these races, they let them fly however they wanted and land to refuel wherever they wanted. The women were forced, when they were finally given the opportunity, to stop in 15 different towns along the way. Because as the men said, and this was their word, we don't think you have the, quote, stamina to do it. And so by 1933, a handful of women have now proven they do have stamina. They do have ability. And because of Florence's particular ability flying in pylon races, she is invited to Chicago by the promoter of the races, specifically asked to come, and then given an opportunity to fly that day. And they make a grand show of it on the field. They announce that this is, we're making history right here. Florence Klingensmith is going to race the men.
Well, I was wondering, Keith, if you might be able to read an excerpt from your book, Fly Girls. And this is a description of that race on the eighth lap of the Frank Phillips Trophy race. Again, 1933, and Florence Klingensmith is flying in a borrowed airplane? A borrowed GB, is that right?
Correct. And the listeners will probably be interested to know the GBs were built right here in Massachusetts. They were built in Springfield, Mass. For a handful of years in the late 1920s, early 1930s. An extremely fast plane and also extremely dangerous.
Okay.
At the home pylon on the eighth turn, roughly 60 miles in, her GB faltered, buckling under a familiar problem. The right wing, the same wing that had doomed GBs in the past, was failing. Fabric whipped away in chunks and fell to the ground like confetti. And with the air now whistling through the holes in her wing, Klingensmith peeled off course. She was flying away from the crowd in the grandstand, then over the spectators in their parked cars at the edge of the safety fence, then beyond the railroad tracks, heading south toward Chicago, then out over the streets of Glenview, in trouble. "Bail out," one pilot on the ground said, pounding his fist into the back of the man standing in front of him. "Jump, Florence. Jump now."
That's Keith O'Brien reading from his book, Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. I just got the goosebumps just hearing you.
Oh, thank you.
Describe what Florence was experiencing. Do you mind if we give a little spoiler? Because I have to ask.
I don't mind.
It doesn't sound so good. What happens to her?
I don't mind. You know, this is the turning point in Fly Girls. And when I stumbled onto this flight, this race, in my research, I knew right then that this was the moment. Because when men crashed in these races, as they inevitably did, and when they died, the men, as they inevitably did, they were often hailed as heroes and given grand tributes on the airfield that very weekend with 21-gun salutes and flybys and their ashes scattered from planes flying overhead. And when the women crashed and when the women died, they didn't get that sort of thing. And, you know, unfortunately, in September 1933, in this moment over the sky in Chicago, Florence is going to crash. And when she goes down, she is going to die. And this happened all the time. But when it happens to a woman, when it happens to Florence racing the men, they blame her. They blame her for her failure. And in doing so, they don't even give her the most basic, decent human respect. You know, shipping her body home to Minnesota in a box, naked and wrapped in newspapers. The coroner, when he received the body in her hometown of Minnesota, would later say he'd never seen anything like it. In 50 years of receiving bodies to be buried and prepared for burial, he had never seen anything like it. And it wasn't just that. Because of her death that day, the air races and the air race organizers would make a decision. They would decide to ban the women from racing. You know, no more racing for the women at the national air races. This obviously infuriated the women, Amelia Earhart and Louise Thaden and Ruth Nichols and Ruth Elder and the other leading flyers of the day, and it set up a bitter feud between the male and female aviators that would stretch for years, but ultimately end with the women triumphing in the end.
This is so heartbreaking, but also it sounds so typical, right? That the woman gets blamed for, I don't know what, bad flying, but for, well, actually, what specifically was she blamed for?
It's actually infuriating what they blamed her accident on. In the autopsy that would take place the next day, they would call multiple witnesses. And one of the things that comes out at the autopsy, one of the questions that the coroner has for the witnesses, and including the witness that was called from the air races, was, did you know, he asked, did you know that this woman was on her period at the time?
God.
They blamed her failure to fly with a broken wing on the fact that she was menstruating. And, you know, it sounds crazy to us, right? It's sexist, it's absurd, it's demeaning. But rules at the time, written rules under the U.S. Department of Commerce, said that a woman should not fly a plane, operate a plane within 3 days of her menstrual cycle, of her period. And, you know, I found it, I was just blown away. Florence was so talented, and she gave everything, literally, her life, to do what she loved. And in the end, you know, for that sacrifice, she gets blamed. She gets nothing. The men use it as an excuse to ban the rest of the women. And then maybe one of the worst injustices of all, we've forgotten her.
Yeah. Yeah. It is stunning, because even in just the excerpt that you read, just to remind folks, I mean, the plane was falling apart around her. And yet, because of the fact of her biology, she gets blamed for the crash, and women subsequently get banned from the race. I mean, it's typical, but also it doesn't fail to be upsetting. But nevertheless, Keith, I mean, you write about how these women changed aviation history, whether or not we knew it today until your book came out. Because it feels like for other women in the group, I mean, I'm thinking particularly of Amelia Earhart now. She obviously became very famous, but met an untimely end as well. How did they change aviation history? Because couldn't we say that for many years thereafter, like you just said, it was still flying kept being a very masculine, very, very macho pastime sport? Job, tradition. So how do they change it?
It's a great question. And you're right. For not just for years afterwards, for decades.
Yeah.
The airlines wouldn't hire they hired their first female pilot as a commercial airline pilot in 1934. It did not go well because the men didn't admit her to the union, and within months she was essentially forced to resign. The airlines would wait 40 more years, 1973, before another woman was hired. I mean, that's the kind of world we're talking about here. But women, these aviators changed things in two fundamental ways. Number one, flying was very dangerous in this era. And by proving that they could do it, by proving that they could fly and they could race and they could win, they helped show other people that flying was possible. And manufacturers knew it. They knew there was value in having a woman fly their plane because of that. The second thing they proved was what a woman could do. We take flying for granted now. It's at best the way we get from point A to point B. At worst, we complain about it.
Yeah.
It's a hassle. At the time, flying was magic. You know, it was the ultimate symbol of freedom. And so if you were someone who could prove it was possible, if you were a woman who could prove you could make it in the sky, well, you proved a lot to other women, other girls on the ground.
Well, Keith O'Brien's new book is Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. He's going to be reading from the book tonight at the Brookline Booksmith at 7. We'll have more information about that at radioboston.org. Keith, thank you so much for the book, for telling the story of women like Florence and Ruth and Amelia again. And thanks again for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, so fortunately, I don't actually have to spend a ton of time in cars, but last week I did because I was shuttling my kid back and forth to and from camp. And, you know, traffic has been atrocious because of all of that Comm Ave bridge construction. So one day last week, I'm on the Mass Ave bridge. I'm totally stuck, dead standstill. And this song comes on. And I'm so excited because I love this song.
I hear the drums echoing tonight, but she hears only whispers of some quiet conversation.
Okay, but hang on here, because something's wrong, right? I'm thinking, is this a recently unearthed demo track of Toto's Africa? A song I have loved since I was 7 years old. And then they hit the chorus. Oh my God, so wrong, so horrible. But you kind of have to rubberneck through a song like this just to find out who hammered out this atrocity. And I finally, at the end of the track, I find out, thanks a lot, Mix 104, it's Weezer. Now, the thing I don't get, this cover is on super heavy rotation right now. It's everywhere. And why? I mean, it is so very bad. It tries so hard to mimic the original, the classic, which, by the way, just to get the bad taste of the Weezer cover out of our system, let's listen to Toto from 1982. Yeah, you see, that's how you're supposed to do it, right? Now, it made me wonder about this eternal question. Why do some covers stink, but others actually become more famous than the original? So joining me now to help me answer this endless mystery is Melissa Farrick. She's Associate Professor of Songwriting at Berklee College of Music. Melissa, it is great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I should say you performed with Weezer, right?
I have. I toured with Weezer during the big, huge tour. I mean, like 1995 when they had Buddy Holly. It was amazing.
You were shaking your head.
Well, because they're so good. I love Weezer.
And
I can't believe this happened. I did the same thing. I suffered through the entire song.
Oh, my God, yes.
And then when they said it was Weezer, I was like, what? I didn't even recognize them as Weezer.
We're going to come back to this in just a second because I do want to introduce another guest. Joining us from New York is Ray Padgett. He's the author of the book Cover Me, the stories behind the greatest cover songs of all time. He's also creator of the website covermesongs.com. Ray, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
It is great to have you. Now, listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've got a ton of songs we want to play today, but if you have one of your favorite cover songs that you want to just give a shout out to, call us at 800-423-8255 or send me a tweet at Radio Boston. Now, okay, so Melissa and Ray, getting back to this Weezer debacle, Melissa, can you explain this? Like, what are they trying to do here? I don't get it.
Well, I'm really glad. So one of the things that I had said the other day was I've really been upset about this for a while, to be honest with you. I've been upset about this
cover. Because it's terrible.
Yeah, it's really bad. And Rivers is smarter than this. And so finally, I came to the conclusion that they must have done this so badly on purpose. And and now it's been confirmed that is true, that they did this cover because they were harassed by a fan. I think they took probably 50 minutes to do this.
Okay.
It's so bad because it's like trying to be exactly the same, except for this like horrific electric guitar, but way worse.
So yeah. Wait, Ray, is Melissa saying that it's the result of some sort of Twitter harassment or what?
Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
It's sort of, even if you hate the cover, I kind of like the story behind it, which is that a 14-year-old girl in Cleveland one day had some random idea that she likes Weezer, she likes Africa. She starts a Twitter account called literally Weezer Cover Africa by Toto, and like daily is tweeting at the band members and their manager and their web developer for months. And so fine, and it goes, viral is a strong word, but it gets a few hundred followers. Vice interviews her at one point. And so Finally, they cover, and this is the part I love the most, they cover the Toto song Rosanna.
Oh.
But then 2 days later, they finally succumb and actually cover the Toto song she wanted them to cover, which was Africa.
Okay, and do we know what Toto thinks about this?
Oh, Toto is loving it. Are you kidding?
Oh, come
on.
It's
relevant in decades.
No. Yeah.
They're covering tomorrow. They are releasing their response cover of Weezer's song Hashpipe.
Oh, this is fantastic. Now I love it.
Now you love it?
Yeah, now I want to join in.
The story,
I think we should all start
covering. I just wish the cover was better.
What does it say about, I mean, Melissa, what does it say about commercial radio? Sorry, guys, but that this song, I mean, it's, I think I heard it in an hour like 6 times.
You did?
Yeah, well, I don't really listen to commercial radio, so I listen to BUR and jazz. That's about it. But yeah, I don't know. There just is so much great music out there, and there's so many great covers. Like, why bang this one constantly?
Okay, so we're going to move on from Weezer and Toto. We can come back to Weezer overall here. But speaking of great covers,
nice.
We have so many lined up here for this conversation. Melissa, what's one of your favorites?
So I have to bring up Killing Me Softly.
Okay.
Also, because it's the 20th anniversary of Ms. Lauryn Hill's The Miseducation. But the Fugees nailed this. This was originally made famous by Roberta Flack, of course, in 1973. But it was originally written by this guy named Charles Fox and Norman Gimbel, who released it under this artist, Lori Lieberman, in 1971. So this is a great example of a song that first comes out and does nothing, then comes out pretty soon after, and Roberta Flack nails it, and Lauryn Hill's vocal on this track is just...
It's amazing.
Unbelievable.
So we have both versions, the Roberta Flack version and the Fugees version. First, let's hear Roberta Flack from 1973.
Strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly.
I mean, it's luscious, right?
Yeah, forget it. I mean, you can't stop listening.
But then, 1997, the Fugees.
Better.
Oh, this is one of my favorite songs of all time. Here it is.
I heard he sang a good song. I heard he had a style. And so I came to see him and listen for a while.
We could probably play the whole song and suck up all the time in this segment. And anyone who's not singing along to this, you have no soul. Amazing. Ray Padgett, I mean, that's one of Melissa's favorites. When you hear the two, the Roberta Flack version and the Fugees version side by side, why does that cover work so well?
The cover works so well because essentially, and I interviewed some of them for my book, what they did was they loved the Roberta Flack version and Lauryn Hill wanted to sing it to showcase her voice. But, you know, they're a rap group and they're thinking, how do we sing a Roberta Flack song on a hip hop album? And so finally what Praz came up with is basically Lauryn Hill will sing her beautiful interpretation of the vocals, but they will play it over a beat from an old Tribe Called Quest song. And that's what that song is. It's basically Lauryn Hill doing an amazing vocal over this hip hop beat. And so, you know, then it's close enough and it bridges the gap.
Oh, it's so good. Okay, I'm going to go to the phones here. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And I'm trashing on Weezer for their terrible cover of Toto's Africa. And look, Matthew from Somerville is here to tell me I'm wrong. Matthew, you're on the air. Hello, Matthew.
Yes, hello.
Hi. What do you think?
Hi, yes. Yeah, I listen to NPR every single day. I love this show. And this is literally the first time I've ever called in because once you started talking about how much you hated the song, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I admit I am a Weezer fan. I even saw them down at Jones Beach, and they absolutely killed this cover. Everyone I've talked to loves this song, so... I was just a little bit shocked that there was such
animus. I know it's not very
you.
NPR of me. I can be more balanced here. So Matthew, tell me, why do you love it? The reason why I have an issue with it is because it sounds like they put it together in 15 minutes. Like Melissa said, it's a really hews closely to the original, but not so closely that it pays homage to it. I mean, I don't even know what they're trying to do. Why do you like it?
Well, I mean, I love the song, the original song by Toto, of course. And I like that it's a little bit more rock, a little bit more high energy. There's one point, it's only a few seconds long in the middle of the song where they do a little bit of a jam out in there. I feel like it's not necessarily better than the original, but I think it's a nice spin on the original, and I appreciate both versions.
All right. Matthew, thank you so much for your call. Melissa, are you convinced yet?
Well, now I like it because of that. I didn't know it was a 13-year-old. So I have a soft spot for musicians who actually, you know what I mean? But I'm now liking the idea more of like Weezer doing Toto, now Toto doing Weezer.
Yeah.
And then like that, this could become a cool thing.
Okay. Ray Padgett, I want to turn back to you here. We heard one of Melissa's suggestions for a favorite cover with Killing Me Softly. Is there one that you like in particular?
Sure. We've been talking about this Weezer cover that doesn't change the song very much at all. One of my favorite covers changes the song a lot. It's Devo's take on Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones.
Ah, okay. So here we've got the Stones version again. This is 1965, the Rolling Stones with Satisfaction. Okay, Mick Jagger doing his thing there. Everyone knows that song. So here's the Devo version of Satisfaction. Rafe Padgett, this is from 1978, right?
Yes, from their first album.
Okay, the album Q, Are We Not Men? A, No, We Are Devo. Ray, I had never heard this before, and I'm a little bit on the fence, so tell me why you love it.
I think I love it maybe for the reason you're on the fence, which is that they threw out pretty much everything you would recognize from the original song other than the lyrics. You know, the Keith Richards famous riff, gone. The rhythm, changed. The sort of sexiness and swagger and everything Mick Jagger brings, gone. When I interviewed them, they basically said, you know, it's not like they're making fun of the Stones. They love them, but they were trying to create a bridge. They had this, you know, weird sound that only a few art school kids liked. No one else could figure out what the heck Devo was all about. So they said, what if we take a song everyone knows, but Devo-fy it? And, you know, it worked. They had bigger hits later, but they said they never would have had a career without this Satisfaction cover.
Melissa, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd never heard that version either. I think it's awesome. I love it when someone destroys something but brings new light to it, yeah. Especially when they like the song already, you know, when where it's like they appreciate the song. And I like that they didn't change the lyrics. I don't like it when people change the lyrics. I especially don't like it when people change the gender, like when women singers do a cover and they say he or they say, it says she and then they change it to he. Like Sean Colvin did that. And I was like, oh, God.
On which song?
I can't remember right now. She made a covers album. Do you know which one it was, Ray?
Oh, actually. Okay.
We don't want to go off.
One of my favorites is from that album.
Yeah, it's a great album.
Okay.
But I'm just saying
Cover Girl's the album, and I think it's Every Little Thing He Does is
Magic. Yeah, that's right. It's the lead song.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, well, since you just brought up Sean Colvin, I'm actually going to play a pair off that album, that Cover Girl album, 1994 from Sean Colvin. This is a cover she did of a Talking Heads classic.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so she did a cover of This Must Be the Place, Naive Melody. Talking Heads put this out in 1983. So let's listen to their version first. Oh. I love this song, okay? So then Sean Colvin comes up in 1994 again. The album is Cover Girl. Does something completely different. Oh, that's where I want to be. And I guess I'm already there. I come home. You lifted a few. I guess this must be. Now, part of why I love this song happens to be because in 1994, I was a freshman in college and I was like, depressed and sitting in my dorm room, and this song, this version, it's quiet, it's tender, it reached out to me. So I have an emotional resonance with it. But what I really like is that, I mean, again, she takes this very energetic, very classically Talking Heads song and makes it her own. But it retains, I don't know, it retains a soulfulness, which I hear in both versions. But there's never going to be any confusing the two, Melissa. That's why I like it.
Yeah, they're coming from two different emotional places I think. And, you know, Sean does this song live. I've toured with her a lot. She nails it. She nails a lot of covers live. She's very, how could you not listen to that voice? I mean, when she sings, she means it. She finds a way into the lyric that comes from a truthful place for herself. And I think that ultimately is what makes a great cover song.
Yeah. Let's take a couple more calls here. Wow, you guys really want to talk about covers. Karen is calling from Southboro. You're on the air, Karen.
Magna, this is a great topic. I've often had that thought. I wish people would cover that, really knock it out of the park. And one example I wanted to remind you guys of and play for everybody is Wilson Pickett's cover of Hey Jude with Dwayne Allman on the backup. It just made it better than even that iconic band made it.
Yeah,
so
wow.
That's my comment.
Karen, I wish we could play it. I mean, one of these days we'll get the tools of a music station and we'll be able to call music just like that. But Wilson Pickett's Hey Jude, great suggestion. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Nolan, who's calling from Somerville. You're on the air, Nolan.
Hi. So I have another example from the Beatles, which I think is vastly better than the original, when Joe Cocker covers With a Little Help from My Friends. I think the original is kind of not worth listening to, but Joe Cocker turns it into an amazing ballad.
Oh, Nolan, I'm about to agree with you. I am, because I didn't even know for the longest time that the Beatles were the original version of Get By With a Little Help from My Friends, but Melissa Farrick is shaking her head like, how could you?
I mean, this is just mind-blowing to me. I want to have coffee with you and talk about this for like 3 hours. I mean, like, just no one really should cover the Beatles. I mean, unless it's some artist who's so established and already an icon. And I can bring up the horrific cover of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds by the Flaming Lips, Miley Cyrus, and Moby. It's like, out of those three people, no one in the room said, maybe this isn't a good idea.
Okay, so we have this. We don't even need to play the Beatles original because everybody knows that song. But so here's what Flaming Lips and Miley Cyrus did.
We just have to stop.
That's enough, right? But why would Melissa?
What?
Like you teach songwriting. Yeah. Why would someone try? Why?
I don't know. I don't have any.
Okay,
idea.
Ray, do you have an answer to that?
Sure. So I think I agree. First of all, that's a terrible cover. But I fully and wholeheartedly disagree with, I think everyone should cover the Beatles. I think everyone should cover everyone. I fully support anyone's right to cover that song. I love the Joe Cocker version just as much as the caller does. I hate that one. But, you know, the Beatles are, I do agree with this part of it. The Beatles are very hard to cover in the sense that they, not only are they great songwriters, but they perfected the recordings originally. Yeah. In sort of the opposite way of like a Bob Dylan, where everyone knows he's a good songwriter, but his, you know, performances are acquired tastes. The Beatles, the arrangements are perfect, which is why I think the Joe Cocker one is so good, that it's rearranged as this soul song and, you know, not trying to cover the Beatles exactly.
Huh. Okay. Well, so switching gears here for a second, we got a tweet, Melissa, from David Dietz, if I said your name correctly, David. He's tweeting, if Melissa does not like gender-changing covers, what does she think of Aretha's Respect?
Well, Aretha Franklin can do whatever she wants. I don't. And I'm going to agree with Ray a little bit. I'm going to back up my statement about the Beatles. I think you're right, Ray. And also, just because I have so many students that are young at Berkeley, it's important to keep recording songs by greats so that our new generations know these songs, because otherwise they don't know who these people are, which is like shocking to me.
Yeah. Look at all these people wanting to have their say. We got another tweet here saying the obvious, Jeff Buckley's Hallelujah,
yeah,
Johnny Cash's Hurt. John Dankosky, hello, John from Connecticut. He says, I have two for you. David Bowie revered Lou Reed. And I think this Live at the Beeb recording of White Light is nearly perfect for a rock recording. Liz is saying Hello by Adele, or any cover by Adele. So we got so many favorites here. Melissa, you've got another one. I think of ones that you like. Oh, that has to do with Oasis?
Yeah, which is a band that a lot of people loved to hate.
But, I loved to
but
love them.
What? Me too. What great songwriters. Yeah, so Ryan Adams nailed their song Wonderwall in an acoustic version. And Ryan Adams really came out, you know, and supported Oasis as a great band. And they've toured together too. So it's a wonderful version.
All right, here's Oasis with the original 1995 Wonderwall. Here we go.
Today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. By now you should have somehow realized what you gotta do. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now.
Gen X reigns supreme, ladies and gentlemen, but let's fast forward to 2003. Here's Ryan Adams' cover of Wonderwall.
Today was gonna be the day they'll never bring it back to you. By now you should have somehow realized what you gotta do. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now.
And Melissa, I heard that Oasis also loved this song. That they actually maybe even preferred this version over their own?
Yeah, well, these people are friends too, you know? Okay. So, that, yeah, for sure. I can't believe how much I love when I love when Ryan Adams does other people's songs anyway. So I just love the emotional shift between the two of them. And I know we heard the beginning of the original version, but, you know, drums come in and there's all sorts of other hooks. So when I heard this so stripped down with the beautiful echo and chorus on it, I just was like, this is beautiful.
Ray Padgett, what do you think?
As has probably become clear by now, I like covers that change something. And Ryan Adams in this and everything totally changes it, not just the arrangement, but even the melody he's mixing up. And as Melissa said, he puts out a cover practically every month. It's all we can do at the site to keep up with them. And it's everything from Iron Maiden to Willie Nelson to 2 years ago he did an entire album of Taylor Swift covers. And sort of everything he does is interesting, and he always changes it.
Okay, well, you mentioned Taylor Swift here. So I'm looking through my big list. We have a list of songs. Where did it go, guys? Because she did a cover of September, right?
Yeah, okay. About 2 months ago.
So let's play the original version here if we can. Do you guys have it? Here it is. Okay, obviously everybody knows and loves that song. And here's what Taylor Swift did it in a cover from April of this year. Again, it's the cover of Earth, Wind & Fire's September. This is Taylor Swift. Radio and not Melissa Farrick's face. Did you just give me a what just
happened?
No, I'm
just so glad I've never heard that before. I'm so glad that I've been on the planet for however long it's been since she put this out and didn't ever hear it. I mean, that is just...
What's wrong with it? I mean,
everything.
Come on.
I just don't... You just can't do something that bad to a song that great. I mean, there's no emotional... I guess I get stuck on the emotional connection between the performance of it and, like, the lyric content. There's just nothing that's... I don't feel anything when Taylor Swift's this, besides the banjo situation.
Well, when I heard it, my first five questions were, is that a banjo?
Right.
Is that a banjo? Why is there a banjo there? But Ray Padgett, I mean, on the other hand, you know, she's not trying to copy the original, so...
She sure isn't.
So what do you think?
So I think I appreciate what she's going for, that I am not inherently opposed to a banjo-led cover of September. In fact, I think that could be kind of interesting.
Yeah.
The way she delivers it, the production, the sort of overly earnest or fake earnest vocals, I think it's pretty unlistenable. But I'm not opposed to the idea of a country and western banjo bluegrass cover of September, if anyone else out there wants to try
it. Yeah, totally.
All right. So, Melissa, we've just got a couple seconds here. You teach songwriting at Berklee. You're working with a lot of up-and-coming musicians.
Yeah.
Is there a lure? Like, do they want to do covers and do they want to do them in the right way?
Yeah, they're doing them all the time and putting them. They're doing them quickly and putting them up on YouTube because they think that by doing that, that's going to get them on the Ellen DeGeneres show and make them famous. So it's not really coming from a place of I really want to do this and do it well and pay homage to this song that I think is amazing. So I get concerned about my students doing it all the time.
All right. Well, yeah. Hopefully they've listened to this and they're getting some pointers on how to do it right. Melissa Farrick, Associate Professor of Songwriting at Berklee College of Music. Thank you so very
Thanks
much.
Thanks for having
it's
me.
It's so great to have you. And Ray Padgett, author of Cover Me, the stories behind the greatest cover songs of all time. Also creator of CoverMeSongs.com. Ray, it was great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Magna.
And listeners, thank you for calling in with your favorite covers and for tweeting me as well. We're going to go out with the original, the classic, Toto from 1982. This is Africa. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Dogs cry out in the night as they grow restless, longing for some solitary company. I know that I must do what's right. Sure.